Confident Parents, Remarkable Kids, 8 Principles for Raising Kids You'll Love to Live With, by Bonnie Harris. Published by Adams Media, copyright 2008. Read by the author.
Introduction. My children taught me 2 important lessons. Each child is completely different and requires different expectations, and neither punishment nor reward teaches anything worthwhile. By watching my children, discovering what helped and what didn't, I became fascinated with human behavior, why parents and children respond to each other the way they do, and how that interaction affects children's future behavior and well-being. When I read Louise Kaplan's Oneness and Separateness, From Infant to Individual, in graduate school, I gained enormous empathy for the confusion and frustration of young children and learned the implications of misunderstanding their behavior. My son was only 4 at the time, but already I was sorry I hadn't had access to this information earlier. From then on, I devoted my parenting and my teaching to figuring out what children were going through and why they behaved the way they did. I learned to see life through the eyes of the child. I brought up my children by the principles I write here, not as fully developed as what I teach now, and I'm pleased to report firsthand on their effectiveness. My children are now adults, and both embody the qualities I hoped they would have, as well as some I never anticipated. They're remarkable young people whom I admire tremendously. They learn to be respectful, responsible, caring people without punishment. They were a joy to live with most of the time, and we continue to have a mutually loving relationship. If you don't want your children to leave the nest without so much as a glance backward, now is the time to begin focusing on and nurturing what you admire, respect, and love about them. As a teacher of parent education over the past 20 years, who's worked with parents in different parts of the world, I have learned a lot about what you want. You want to be the best parent you can be, but you get easily frustrated and say and do what you swore you wouldn't. You don't want to raise your children the way you were raised, but you're at a loss as to what to do instead. You want to teach your children right from wrong, but you know the old ways don't work for your kids. Maybe you've learned that timeouts and punishment don't work, but when impatience or guilt gets the best of you, you fluctuate between empty threats and giving in. You're exhausted from daily power struggles and endless arguments and overwhelmed by the effort it takes in the limited time you have. You want your children to have the voice you never had, but when they use it, your button gets pushed because they say and do what you never dared. You want desperately to do what's right, to have happy, responsible children, but your methods keep backfiring. The world is different today. You're different, and your children have the advantage. They know you don't want to use force and fear tactics to raise them. They can speak their minds and be freer spirits. This is the good news. The bad news is that you may not know how to effectively set limits and say no without resorting to those fear tactics. And perhaps you're struggling with your own self-worth. You want your children to love you and are afraid of the reactions you'll encounter if you say no. Or you say no but feel worn down when your children don't listen or do what you say. You want to be in control, but your children bring you to your knees. When parenting methods swing from best buddy to empty threats, your children find leverage. They learn that they will not be held accountable. Not really. Hitting, yelling, grounding, and isolating don't work with most of today's kids because they won't stand for it. They're not afraid the way you were. They demand respect, but you misread their demands as acts of defiance and disrespect, because that's what your parents did. The key to turning this around, to finding a better way, is a change in perception. Simple, but enormous. But you have to want to change and be committed to practice. It will seem like learning a foreign language. You might think you're letting your kids get away with something. It's hard at first to believe that fairness and logic can be effective discipline methods. Letting go of old habits is the hard part. Your children need you to be in charge. That's your responsibility. But being in charge means keeping your cool and staying calm in the face of even the most difficult situations. It's easy to lose control. It's hard to stay detached enough to remain in charge. Each success story I hear from a parent includes, "I was able to stay calm," or "I didn't lose it." We're not responsible for our children's feelings and behavior, but we are fully responsible for our own. Their behavior reflects what they experience. When we take responsibility for ourselves and stop trying to get our children to change, we change. When we act like the grown-ups we're meant to be, our children can act like the children they are. Children you'll love to live with. The 8 principles presented in this book can change your life. They will help you develop your parenting philosophy. Having a core philosophy provides you with a reservoir from which to draw, so that whatever situation may arise, or whatever your state of mind, your response is consistent and grounded. We need principles to rely on in times of stress, when we don't have time to think, when dinner's burning, when the baby's crying, when siblings are fighting, when we're impatient and tired, and when crisis hits. Holding these 8 principles means that parenting decisions are consistent no matter what, and yours and your children's needs are ensured and in balance. Add your personal and cultural values to these 8 ingredients, and your parenting will be a recipe for success. You will always question and have doubts. You will make plenty of mistakes. You'll never be perfect. But knowing you have dependable principles to rely on will inject your parenting with confidence. When doubting friends and relatives question your attitude and decisions, you'll have solid ground to stand on. You'll be able to explain your decisions, stand up to arguments, and even influence others toward more mindful parenting. Helping your children through their problems will bring you satisfaction and fulfillment. You will be amazed at how much easier it can be, and without reverting to those methods you hate. In fact, you can raise children who are a joy to live with and who will look to you for a safe and nurturing relationship throughout their lives. Confident Parents, Remarkable Kids is the book you will wish your parents had read. The 8 chapters in Part 1 fully describe each of the 8 principles, illustrated with true stories throughout. The end of each chapter lists the main points and offers practices to help you apply the principles to your own life. Once you apply them, you will begin to look for and see your children's qualities and capabilities rather than irritations and inadequacies. You will understand their behavior as clues rather than calamities, and learn to be a detective rather than a police officer. You'll learn how to connect with your children, even in the toughest times, and teach them to problem solve, take responsibility, and be accountable for their actions, without punishment or blame. And you'll regain the authority that your children really do want you to have. Part 2 takes you through 7 aspects of a common ordinary day in the life of 7 families and shows you how the principles are applied. These stories are filled with suggestions for ways to solve daily dilemmas that can be adapted to your own family. Although the stories in this book cover toddlers to preteens, the principles hold true throughout the entire course of your parent-child relationship. Children are cooperative and respectful when there is balance in the family, like a mobile dancing in the breeze. But if one element of the mobile is too heavy, it will not dance. Equalize the weight and balance is restored. When either your needs or your child's needs consistently hold more weight, the balance is off. Learn the dance and find out how much more enjoyable life can be. Part 1, The 8 Principles of Confident Parenting. Chapter 1, The First Principle. My Child Wants to Be Successful. "I hate you. You never let me have anything I want. I wish I had Jeff's mom. She lets him play that game all the time. You're so lame." Well-practiced, 8-year-old Jared ran the familiar litany when Kathleen said no, again, to his plea for the video game that everybody else gets to play. Telling Jared no to anything he wanted was a surefire invitation to meltdown. His begging was insatiable, the meltdowns frequent. No one could argue and wear Kathleen down like Jared, her most stubborn child, number 3 out of her 4 children. She knew the arguing and hurtful remarks wouldn't stop until he was asleep that night and she fell exhausted and disheartened into bed. Successful was the last word Kathleen would use to describe Jared's behavior. Every day it's something else, she complained. Can I have that? I have to do this. He drives me crazy. I swear I just don't like him sometimes. He makes me yell until I'm hoarse, and then he laughs at me. I send him to his room, put him in time out, take away his privileges. I've tried everything. Nothing works. Why can't he just do what I ask, ever? Why does life have to be like this? Life doesn't have to be like this. The problem for Kathleen is that the everything she has tried is a series of techniques that keep her spinning in a vicious cycle, leading her into a sequence of fears and expectations that set children like Jared up for failure again and again. He doesn't stand a chance. Kathleen is a loving and caring mother. Her intentions are good, but her frustrations overwhelmed her. She regularly assumed that Jared was going to be a pain in the neck before he even opened his mouth. She knew she would spend her day simply trying to get through it without a meltdown. She believed that the only way to get him in line was with control, but mostly she felt out of control. Punishments didn't work. He resisted her threats and just got angrier. She blamed him. She blamed herself. When blame and control set the foundation of a relationship, nothing works. And nothing did until Kathleen found a way to step outside her box, her familiar frame of perceptions and expectations, to see Jared differently and to respond to him instead of react. After that, the whole family dynamic began to change. At the end of her rope, Kathleen came to me for counseling. It was soon clear that her perception of Jared kept her stuck in frustration and anger. Her focus was on his failures. So Jared saw himself reflected in her eyes as a failure. Kathleen needed to step into Jared's shoes to see what his world looked like to him, to hear what her words sounded like, and to change what her eyes, voice, and body language were communicating to him. She couldn't change him, but she could change how she saw him. We revisited scene after scene in which his stubbornness, arguing, and cutting remarks revealed at a deeper level his need to be heard. But since Kathleen took his behavior at face value and saw him only as defiant and rude, he had to push harder and louder in his attempt to make her listen. He didn't know how to say, "Hey, Mom, all I need you to do is accept me. I get all wound up when I think you hate me and wish I were more like my brother." All Jared could do was try to reach her with his behavior, his cue that he felt frustrated, confused, and misunderstood. He was reacting to expectations that told him he could never get it right. He'd come to believe he was a pain, and so he acted that way. Kathleen didn't understand his cues or her own expectations. It never occurred to her that she and her husband were the ones who needed to change first. Basic trust. Children want to be successful. No child is happy being manipulative or out of control. Success in this context is defined as a sense of personal rightness and accomplishment in one's developing ability to express needs and have them met, of being in balance or alignment with oneself and one's world, to be in a state of regulation or stability. A successful child feels confident in himself and emotionally secure. His behavior is appropriate to his temperament and stage of development. This definition of success has nothing to do with the acquisition of things, money, or accomplishments, but with inner balance and well-being. At the core of raising a successful child must be a basic trust in the individual and the developmental process. It requires parents to step back and watch, to understand and trust the child's motives, and to learn who he is and what he is capable of before stepping in to censor his behavior. As soon as Kathleen got it, guilt flooded her. Now she worried that she'd damaged Jared for life. I convinced her that to change her perception would feel like a gift to him, once he trusted that her change was genuine. Such healing can happen at any time. Sometimes it's immediate, and sometimes it takes time, but it's never too late. With practice and continued awareness of her reactions, Kathleen was able to see that different perceptions of Jared's behavior helped him. Trusting these new perceptions was the hard part. But soon she could see that he really was trying hard. He wasn't out to get her or wear her down. It was her fears telling her that. So she decided to give him a chance. "Oh, man, look at this!" Jared exclaimed as he and his mother approached a display of CD players on their way to the toy department to fetch a birthday present for Jared's friend. "Okay, here it comes," Kathleen thought. "Can I do it?" She instantly played out the old battle they would have had in her head. Jared had broken his CD player. He would beg for a new one. In the old script, she would say something like, "No, Jared, come on, hurry up. I told you we weren't getting anything but the birthday present. I have 1,000 things to do today, and I don't have time for this. If you hadn't been so clumsy with yours, blah, blah, blah." It was always the same, she now realized. Nothing horrible, nothing abusive. But now she could see how her old reactions had that critical tone that set him up to be defensive, stubborn, and a pain in the neck. This time she thought of a different script and decided to take the time. She stopped and looked at what drew his attention. "Yeah, they're pretty cool. All different colors. And all different prices. What are the features that make some more expensive than others?" Jared looked up at his mother in shock. "Is it the different headphones?" Kathleen added gamely. After Jared became convinced this was indeed his mother, he was delighted and proud to educate her on the player's features. Kathleen was amazed at his knowledge. She noticed his whole body relax. He'd been anticipating a fight that didn't happen. "So, if you were to buy one, do you think a more expensive one would be worth the money?" Again, he enthusiastically explained which he would pick and why. Then came the inevitable. "So, can I get one?" Without a pause, Kathleen said calmly, "I'm not going to buy you one, but can you think of a way you can get one yourself?" After a moment of disappointment, the boy's wheels started spinning. Jared then came up with a plan to clean the garage and rake leaves. Now his impatience switched from getting his mom to give in to him to buying the birthday present fast so he could get home and start earning money. It took some time and reminding, but Jared did eventually earn the money. The look on his face when he paid for the CD player was worth the wait, Kathleen reported with pride. "I never would have thought this could happen." Intention for success. Instead of pushing ahead with her own agenda, expecting Jared to follow suit, something that never failed to provoke him, Kathleen stopped to see his agenda. He hadn't meant to be manipulative or stubborn. He was merely looking after his own interest, wanting to share it with his mother, and hoping to get what he wanted. Frustrating, yes, but normal and completely understandable. When a parent sees a child's will as manipulative, disobedient, and stubborn, fears take over and reactions abound. The child's integrity must fend off these angry reactions. The fending off is usually perceived as misbehavior, but the misbehavior is the child's attempt to be successful and in balance. When a child like Jared fends off, his behavior is usually loud, disagreeable, inconvenient, and disruptive. Hardly behavior a parent sees as an attempt at being successful. Jared is an impulsive, distractible, and energetic boy who has a harder time than his siblings cooperating with his mother's agenda and sticking with it. Having a better understanding of his temperament now, Kathleen sees the disconnect she had created because of anticipating his nagging, begging, and arguing. Her expectation of Jared evoked his resistance and the behavior she feared. Now that she can understand his point of view, she's calmer and can set more effective limits on his behavior, preventing some and letting go of some. Kathleen's husband came on board after he saw the changes. Now they rarely assume Jared is up to no good or will never listen. They see his struggle first. They acknowledge that the circumstances at the time, the clashes of agendas, their expectations of him, the level of stress he's feeling, can create his resistance. It's not that he refuses to cooperate. It's that right then he can't. All they focused on before was getting him to change. All they knew was to criticize and punish. But once they understood that Jared wanted to be successful, even when his behavior looked otherwise, Jared began to see himself as more successful in their eyes. Jared did not morph into an easygoing child. His temperament still presents many difficulties, but now his parents' expectations of him are based on who he is, not on who they wish he would be. Their acceptance of him goes a long way toward gaining his cooperation. Walking off the battlefield. Children feel under attack from negative judgments and criticisms and are often left with no choice but to engage in counterattack. If the perceived enemy remains invested in hostility, the power struggle, it's the rare child who can back off and change his behavior. Most adults, and certainly children, think that withdrawing from the attack leaves them too vulnerable, so they persist in a fight to the finish. Defensive reactions appear to be the only chance of surviving the onslaught of criticisms and blame. We do a good job teaching our children strategic maneuvers to get what they want in the power struggles we engage in. But if the parent behaves like a grown-up, she will be the first to leave the battlefield. This doesn't mean that Kathleen always has to do it Jared's way. But if she had been unable to stop to look at the CD players, she could have respectfully said, "Wow, those CD players do look great, don't they? I'm really sorry we can't stop this time. I have so much to do, and I have to ask you to keep going. I appreciate you doing this for me." Jared would have been frustrated. He might even have had a meltdown. But he also would have felt accepted, which has a cumulative effect, just as the opposite does. If Kathleen wants him to respect her, it must start with her respect of him. When she's able to see it his way, he'll be more able to do it her way when he has to. When a child perceives that his parent thinks he's bad, he believes he's bad, so he behaves badly. His defenses go up, and he's tense with readiness for the daily power struggles that he must try to win. Better behavior is unlikely until he gets a different message from his parent. Children are more capable than we think. Understanding that children want to be successful implies a trust in the child's capability, which is fostered by encouragement and correction, never by disapproval. Sometimes that support means stepping in to help the child get back on track by setting limits or problem-solving, and sometimes it means trusting the child's own process. A mother relayed to me her story of moving from the East to the Midwest with two young children, 4 and 2.5. Just before they moved, the mother broke her foot and was in a cast for weeks. She was on crutches for a few of those weeks and quite immobile for the rest. Through the move and unpacking in the new house, her children stepped up to the plate and demonstrated cooperation, helpfulness, and empathy for their mother. When we either don't, or in this case can't, do everything we think we should for our children, they have the chance to show us how capable they are. I recall watching my daughter soon after she had mastered walking. She was climbing the steps on her toy slide and sliding down over and over again. She was so intent on her work that she forgot I was in the room. I didn't remind her. Often she would climb to the top and fall or trip on a step. Each time she got up and tried it again, always differently, until she got it. I watched in awe at her determination and learned how capable she was of correcting her mistakes. I continued watching throughout her childhood and found again and again that trusting her, although not always easy, paid off. Even though many of the decisions she's made in her 20-something years have been frustrating, worrisome, or not ones I would have made, I've learned that by walking away from battles I could have so easily engaged in, her decisions have turned out to be right for her. With basic trust in capability comes acceptance, a need more powerful even than love, even in the face of misbehavior. Born for success. Human beings are programmed for success. We are born with the instincts to cue our environment correctly to get our basic needs met. Babies suck to get food. They cry to be comforted or fed. Nourishment and attachment are basic needs. Withholding food or comfort, you're teaching her that crying will get her what she wants, is punishment intended to stop the crying. When her cues are not answered, she does not learn to stop crying. She learns to distrust her cues. Then she has to try harder, so she cries louder, until that doesn't work either. By training children with our methods to get the behavior we want, we can unintentionally teach our children to distrust their own instincts. When a child's cues are answered, she learns that she's capable, that she is successful. Just as instinctive as the urge to cry and suck is the urge to belong. Humans are social animals. We have lived in society since the beginning of time. We instinctively know how to get along, but we routinely parent with the assumption that our children cannot get along until we socialize them. If a 2-year-old doesn't share his toys, his parent fears selfishness and then attempts to train him to share at an age before his impulses can accommodate sharing. His parent does not trust that socialization will come in due time and interrupts his natural course with attempts at teaching proper behavior. With a belief that children want to be successful, we watch the child's development unfold and trust her developmental process. We expect that she's a unique individual and may socialize differently than others. She may be more shy or more outgoing, introverted or extroverted, but we will help her find her way of appropriate socializing. We distract the 2-year-old from pulling a toy away from another child, understanding that she's not yet ready to share. When she's a little older and no longer distractible, we teach her to take turns by calmly helping her do it, assuring her she will get her turn soon. We make sure that happens. If she screams in dismay, we comfort her, acknowledging her frustration and reassuring her she will get her toy back. We do not take the toy back and give it to her, nor do we take the toy away to teach her a lesson. With steady practice, without yelling, criticizing, or punishing, she slowly learns that she can let go and the toy will return. We have confidence in her natural ability to learn when she's ready and patience to stay the course until she is. We trust that she wants to do it right. If we yell at her or put her in timeout for grabbing the toy, she learns that she's bad for wanting it. She's confused. So she starts to build her defense, which is her natural instinct to protect herself from attack. Then, whenever someone has something she wants, she fights harder and sneakier to get it. We perceive her as mean and manipulative, but she's not being manipulative on purpose. She's learned what she has to do to get what she wants. Getting off track and into the vicious cycle. Our traditional reward and punishment method of parenting implies that a child is naturally unruly and disobedient and requires training to be otherwise. So we train the child to listen, not to his internal cues, but to his parents, who always know best. Like it or not, we set our children up to grow dependent on someone else to tell them whether or not they're okay. Natural connection to internal cues is broken, internal balance is off, and the child is thrown off track and misbehaves. The parent reacts punitively to the misbehavior, and families become entrenched in the vicious cycle. Punishments and rewards train the child to behave the way the parent wants and society expects. We disregard what the child needs, usually out of ignorance, not malice, and try to get the child to do what we want for his own good. Tired parents get to the end of their rope quickly, yell, grab, slap, and manipulate to get their children to stop crying, stop demanding, just stop. These angry, critical reactions are met with resistance from children who are not getting their basic needs of respect and acceptance met. Resistant behaviors further provoke angry reactions from parents who don't understand the emotional roots of the behavior. Their reactions incite further misbehavior, and the cycle spins, often out of control. Many parents don't know how to step off the cycle. They expect their child to. They assume children will self-correct with punishments or negative reactions, but that's not how cycles work. The irony is that, except for the temperamentally adaptable who obey easily, strong-willed children resist controls and inconvenience life for their parents, prompting further controls and reprimands. The autocratic expectation. But there's got to be a line. I have to put my foot down. After all, I'm the parent, and he has to do what I say. Certainly, authority is important. But when punishment is used to control behavior, the child behaves out of fear. Fear creates stress. Stress causes the child to either submit or react, depending on her temperament. The child who's punished doesn't sit pensively contemplating what she just did and how to do it better next time. She's usually angry, resentful, or revengeful. She then defends herself against what she thinks will get her in trouble next time by lying, cheating, laughing, ignoring, hiding, sneaking, running away. And, yes, yelling may get her to stop, this time. Punishment often works at getting a desired result, today. But at what cost? What's the long-term learning? Quick-fix solutions that use fear to motivate offer short-term results. This mindset rules out a thought such as, she's trying to be successful, but something is pulling her off track. By holding all the power, autocratic parents undermine the child's growing capability, initiative, and basic instinct to succeed. The box. Put a plant in a sunny window. Water it regularly. Keep it healthy, and it will grow and blossom. Now put a box over the plant with a hole on one side. The plant will bend toward the hole, toward the sunlight. It will probably stay alive, but it will never be lush and healthy, and will likely never blossom. The child is like this plant. The box represents the oppression of punishment. When punished, even when abused, the child is capable of bending toward the light, attempting to reach approval and acceptance. But the box creates an obstacle that pulls him off track, requiring him to shift off his center and relinquish a strong sense of self. He too may never blossom. The permissive expectation. Many parents too easily relinquish authority due to lack of confidence, too much stress, too little time, or fear of emotions. They may believe that it's healthy for children to express themselves, an experience they may never have had. They may dread their child's anger and confront or deny as little as possible. These children rarely experience disappointment and are slow in developing coping skills. They're often left without the structure they require to learn self-discipline, delay gratification, respect, and empathy. Often parents believe they must continually reaffirm how special their children are to build self-esteem. So permissive parents defer power to the child. Now the balance is off in the other direction. Children take the reins when no one else will, not because they want to, but because they can. Either compensating for the parent's autocratic upbringing, assuaging the guilt of a working parent, or avoiding the child's unhappiness, the overly permissive parent is willing to give and give to meet the child's every desire. But when the child does not appreciate the parent's sacrifice, after all I've done, and she won't even put her clothes away, resentment sets in. How dare you behave that way? The parent may quickly swing to his automatic knee-jerk reaction, the autocratic parenting he experienced, and blow. Then guilt or hopelessness takes over and the parent defers to the child even more. A different kind of cycle spins. Both autocratic and permissive parenting creates obstacles for the child's innate drive towards success. Any child takes what is given, comes to expect whatever treatment is received, and behaves accordingly. If she is thwarted at every turn, she will redirect by learning devious strategies modeled by her parents to get what she wants. If she's always allowed what she wants, she will expect it every time. This is not the child's initial intention, but what she has learned to expect. Neither suppressed nor entitled children respect or have empathy for others. They shirk responsibility and lay blame for their actions elsewhere. 7.5-year-old Mary Beth wore her mother Anne down with demands. She wanted to go skiing, but after Anne packed her and her two siblings in the car and arrived at the ski slope, Mary Beth claimed that her mother had brought the wrong poles. "These aren't mine. What did you bring the wrong ones for?" She refused to ski and wanted to go home. Nothing could appease her. "I'm not going to ski, and you can't make me," until her mother took them all home. The following week, when the day for the ski program rolled around again, her mother asked Mary Beth rather sarcastically, "So, what is it? Are we going skiing tomorrow or not?" Mary Beth said yes, but on the drive up she complained that it was too cold, blamed her mother for bringing the wrong jacket, and again refused to ski and insisted on going home. Mary Beth is not a born spoiled brat. She's been given the freedom to decide whether they stay or go, a decision that gives her too much power. As with most young children, Mary Beth's mind changes rapidly, and she hasn't learned that everyone's needs are as important as her own. Anne's desire to make her daughter happy has set Mary Beth up to take advantage of that desire. with a belief that her child wants to be successful, Anne can ask herself what is blocking Marybeth from behaving appropriately. When she can look for the obstacle, perhaps she can see that too much choice is giving her too much power. Once Marybeth decides she would like to take part in the ski program with her brothers, her choice is narrow. Tomorrow's the ski program. Make sure you have your equipment and the clothes you want to wear together and ready. If Marybeth decides she doesn't want to ski or has forgotten her poles, she can choose between staying in the child care program with a friend in the lodge, if available, or go skiing anyway. True consequences. Going home is not an option, as it is not considerate of three other people. These expectations recognize that Marybeth is capable of taking responsibility for her own gear as well as handling disappointment if she makes a mistake. Children learn best when there's a structure of limits and appropriate expectations they can count on, and when they know their parents are in charge. Discipline is needed, but discipline that builds responsibility and conscience. Mirrors cast spells. Our eyes see our children at their best and their worst. Our eyes are their mirrors. If we want to ensure self-confidence and security, our eyes must reflect our children as successful, unconditional love, even when they're at their worst. It's often not as important what we say or do, but how we do it. Our tone, attitude, and body language speak volumes and cast spells on our children. We are responsible for whether that spell is a good spell or a bad one. Marybeth is struggling under a bad spell. Jared is coming out from under one. What kind of a spell were you brought up under? Are you still under it? Our feeling state sends strong messages, both positive and negative, to our children. To behave appropriately, children need a consistent message, a positive spell that says, "I trust that you want to do what's right." When this is the spell, despite inevitable tantrums, out-of-control impulsivity, disobedience, and natural egocentric behavior, that child becomes the child you'll love to live with, and the child who's fun to be around. As we perceive, so we experience. As the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Max Planck said, "When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change." When your child has become an inert blob on the couch in front of the television or computer, your perception of him as a slug, accompanied by the assumption that he's a lazy bum and the fear that he'll never accomplish anything in life, much less do his homework, will perpetuate his slug-like behavior. Reprimands and criticisms support the expectation of a slug. The picture of a slug is what he sees in your eyes, so he will continue slug-like behavior. He is under the slug spell. To affect this behavior, temporarily put the behavior aside and look to the nature of the child and this first principle. This is difficult when the frame you have been using tells you that taking away TV privileges will teach him to get his act together. The least likely outcome is that punishment will motivate your child. The most likely is that he will be angry and defiant, and you will be inconsistent with the punishment. When you accept that your child wants to be successful, you will see that he doesn't particularly like the life of a slug either, but he doesn't know what else to do right now. You'll look for a way to help rather than criticize. You understand that he's temporarily out of balance with himself. You might engage him in activities with you or create opportunities for him. You can set limits on television viewing, and he can hear you. He doesn't have to like it. If you are accepting, not punishing, it's all in the way you see him. Remember, the obstacle that's in your child's way of behaving successfully is an opportunity. Your child's opportunity to grow beyond and learn from that obstacle, and your opportunity to help your child overcome it and feel fulfillment in the connection. Main ideas from Chapter 1. A successful child feels inner balance and well-being. No child wants to be manipulative or out of control. Misbehavior indicates an obstacle in the way of the child's success. A child is born with natural capabilities and instincts toward socialization. Punishments and rewards can pull a child off his natural course and undermine his innate drive toward success. Walking away from battles can instill trust in the child's capabilities. children cannot be expected to be the first to step off the vicious cycle. Natural, consecutive stages of development are often interfered with by coercive, punitive training methods of untrusting, impatient parents. Rewards and punishments are intended to make parents' lives easier. They do not help the child get back on track where successful behavior is common. Punishment creates fear. Fear equals stress. Stress leads to misbehavior. Good discipline builds responsibility and conscience. Poor discipline, either autocratic or permissive, creates suppressed or entitled children who lay blame elsewhere for their actions. A parent's words, tone of voice, and body language have the power to cast both positive and negative spells over children that can last a lifetime. Practice. The next time you feel frustrated with your child, become aware of where your mind is taking you, what your perception is telling you. Are you expecting misbehavior? Are you fostering your child's abilities and independence, or incompetence and dependence by your reactions? Consciously switch to thinking, if he wants to be successful, what is it that's in his way? Is it emotions, feeling blamed, certain people, an event that's occurred? What is causing the stress? Notice how your feelings change when you think this way. Realize that he's probably unable to deal with whatever the obstacle is and ask yourself, how can I help? Example, she gets really frustrated and angry when her brother's around and fights with him a lot. If it's to get my attention, what can I do? I can pay attention to the times when she's especially aggressive, see if there's a pattern, and anticipate it by giving her a little one-on-one time.